You're listening to Lady Radio from the Women's Collective on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting from unceded Musqueam territory. I'm Katie, and we're in the studio today with Callie, Elizabeth, and Kelly. So tonight we're chatting women in science. So people talk a lot about women in science. They talk about the leaky pipeline. They talk about encouraging young girls to embrace STEM fields in school. Tonight, we're going to steer clear of statistics and take a look at women in science through space and time. First up, we'll have a personal story of how science has showed up in and shaped one woman's life. And then we'll have an interview with the founders of Lady Science, a series of essays that gives historical context to the structure of science. So before we get started, Elizabeth just has a little something she wants to say.
Yeah. Kind of a complicated statement to make. We wanted to make sure that we said something this week about standing in solidarity with UBC Pride, particularly after the events that started this week off. The whole standing in solidarity thing can be a complicated statement to make because if it's not backed up with action, it really doesn't mean anything. And that's something that we've talked about a lot. You know, it's easy to put up posters, but how are you following up that action and how are you actually living that solidarity? So I guess what we just want to say, CITR has always had a mandate of, and I think we really do actively work towards representing specifically underrepresented voices and speaking out about marginalization, particularly as it applies to the LGBTQIA+ community. And that's something that we've always made really part of our mandate. But just particularly from Lady Radio, we just want to send the message out there that we don't stand for this hatred and that this is only the beginning of what we're going to be doing. Like saying that we're standing in solidarity, like these conversations don't stop here. This goes so much past this week and rainbow posters. It is about everyday action. And CITR, like I said, is designed as a space where everyone is welcome. But beyond that, like, we are here for these conversations. You know, we love you. We are sorry. We are here. We are standing beside you. And we're not standing for this. And we're going to keep talking about it. So in terms of UBC Pride, this is the end of Out Week, the last night of the 34th annual Out Week. And so UBC Pride is celebrating tonight, hosting an all-ages dear and queer Valentine's dance in the Great Hall North, in this very building, in the AMS Nest. So entry is free. There will be DJs, a free buffet dinner, and anyone 19 up can get drinks for $2.50. So really recommend going and checking that out. Dancing it out, this has been a long, hard, weird week, and I think this will be a nice kind of send off, a very positive feeling. So really recommend that everyone checks that out.
Cool. Thanks, Elizabeth. So we're going to take a quick break and we'll be back with a story from Anecdotal Evidence. Right now, this is Ramsey with Princess of Cups from Hody Kush on Lady Radio CITR 101.9.
Thank you. CITR student executive and fashion expert, Jonathan Q, what fashion means to him.
Like, it's just aesthetically something that's so ostentatious. Typically. I mean, because of course, I mean, it's also, you know, I mean, when you say fashion, I think people are talking explicitly about consumerism, as opposed to someone who buys, like, you know.
If you really want to know more about fashion, come on down to CITR in the Student Union Building of UBC and pick up some of our merchandise à la mode. Nous avons t-shirts, sweatshirts, socks, and coffee mugs.
But it's also very aesthetically gripping.
To keep you styling in support of the station you love. Isn't that right, Jonathan?
Well, actually, is it? Because, I mean, you know, I was going to say because of the cultural vacuum that we exist within, but then, you know, really, fashion today is kind of derived from the European idea of couture, and that's been around for centuries.
In celebration of Black History Month, the African Descent Society will be holding a forum on February 20th from 9 a.m. to 6 p.m. at East Hastings Ray Cam Community Center. The forum will feature panel discussions and presentations by professors, MLAs, UN workers, and other experts who will be discussing a variety of topics, including racial discrimination, immigration and refugees, and a special honoring of the historical Black community of Hogan's Alley. There will also be music, drum circles, food, crafts, poetry, storytelling, and a heritage walk tour. So come and join this forum on February 20th.
Hey, welcome back. That was accidentally Ramsey Prophecy by Ramsey rather than what we expected to play. So we did have to cut that a little bit short. It was getting pretty cool, but it was a little long. So check that out on her Bandcamp. Up next, we have Anecdotal Evidence, a story from Live's local storytelling series that is, full disclosure, produced by me, where storytellers share stories about how science shows up in their lives. The following story was shared by Kat Anderson about how she has personally experienced science in her life, and it was shared in front of a live audience at our event on May 16th, 2016. Here's Kat.
Hi, I'm Kat. Hi! Oh, you guys are so cool. I'm a marine biologist, and when I was about 20 years old, I was rescued by Polynesian royalty. So true story, but before, it sort of sounds like the main plot line of like one of those trashy romance novels, and like parts of it definitely read like a trashy romance novel. And I'm cool with that, but before we get there, I'm gonna like tell you a little bit about who this person was who got rescued by Polynesian royalty, because it really wasn't this girl standing in front of you. I've been doing science for 10 years now. In fact, June 1st is my 1-year anniversary of the first time someone decided to pay me to do science. So, woo! Yeah, 10 years! And at the time, I was 18, and I had just finished my first year of university, and I was a varsity rugby player, and yeah, and in fact, like, not only was I a varsity rugby player, I was an all-Maine rugby player, which means I was the best tight head prop in the state. Woo! And like, I was a fucking beast. And I was like easily 1 to 3 dress sizes bigger than I am now. And like, just like this. Anyway, and I had this huge hair, and it was just like massive, and it came all the way down to here. And my hair's really curly, and it was just like everywhere. And so to look more badass, I would braid it. And I would braid it into 2 French braids. And so they would kind of look like horns. Like, and if you couldn't guess already, I was a virgin. And on top of that, I was pretty sure I was a lesbian. Like, I was really sure about this. And I say pretty sure because, one, I was wrong. Like, oops. And two, you don't come out to your conservative Christian father who lives in Texas unless you're pretty sure you're gay. You're just like, and I had done this, like, right before. I was like, Dad, I'm gay. I'm going to go study birds. Play rugby. And, like, this is who I was. Which is not exactly, yeah. So, like, actually misidentifying one's sexual orientation is not that uncommon for bisexuals. Because there's sort of this thing that happens in our society where if you live in a fortunate society where they're like, oh, you're either going to be gay or straight. Like, gay is an option, right? Which is awesome. You sort of, like, are like, okay, I'm one of those two things. And it turns out you're not one of those two things. So this story is a little bit about me figuring out that I wasn't one of those two things. So, like, here's this, like, fast forward to 2 years later. Still a virgin. Still, like, a big badass rugby player with, like, horn braids. And, like... But now I'm in the tropics. Like, I'm taking field courses on Moorea in French Polynesia, which is, like, literally from our field station, we could see Tahiti. And we'd be like, hi, Tahiti. And it's beautiful. And so what nobody tells you about research stations, because we kind of keep this all under wraps, because we don't really want anyone to know, but there is, like, a lot of sexual energy at field stations. Like a lot. Like, it's not. And so, like, I had sort of had this, like, vague notion that, like, I might have been attracted to a man or two periodically, but I kind of thought it was, like, internalized homophobia. Like, you know, I was like, no, this can't be real. I'm totally a lesbian. And, I mean, like, I was this big butch of a rugby player. Like, what was I supposed to think? And I liked girls. Like, it totally made sense. Anyway, so, like, I'm on this remote island in the tropics, and there's so much sexual energy, and all the men are shirtless. And, like, having been a lesbian and then started dating men, you sort of have this unique perspective on men that I don't think anyone has, where, like, they're kind of like these mythical creatures. And men never get described as mythical creatures, right? So, like, anyway, so I'm, like, pretty nervous, and I'm like, oh, shit. I'm attracted to men. All of a sudden, I'm 14 again. It's puberty. Where's that puberty book? Like, yeah, what's happening to me? Like, oh my God. So it's like, I'm 14. And so I go to my best friend, Abby, and she's like my roommate. And I'm like, and Abby's like really cool. She's one of those girls who's always understood men. Like, just like men like her, she likes men. It's really easy. She has a boyfriend within a week of showing up any place, like, blah, blah, blah. She's also a yoga instructor. Like, this is Abby. I love Abby. We're still really close friends. I'm going to go visit her this summer. Anyway, and I'm like, Abby, I'm attracted to men, and I'm attracted to one in particular. And so the one in particular is this guy named Mike. And Mike is our dive safety officer. Which means he's like this huge man, very masculine, very big leak from women, who's like covered in tattoos and has like blonde hair, but it's not naturally, well, it's naturally blonde because it was bleached by the sun, and like he's got piercings, and he's just like, I don't know, he's like a total badass. And I'm like, oh my God, Abby, I don't know what to do. Mike, like, how, like, what am I gonna do? And she's like, okay, like, I'm feeling so insecure. I've never worried about my body because women don't care what your body looks like, and men supposedly do. And so I'm just like, this is my body, and I built it for like playing rugby, not for impressing boys. And like, woo! Thank you. Like, what do I do? And Abby's like, calm down. We're just gonna take a step back from Mike, and what we're gonna do is, we're gonna do something that's going to make you feel really like confident and powerful. And I'm like, okay, Abby, what's that? And she's like, we're gonna get naked. And I'm like, Abby, I'm really not into you. Like, I know that I've been saying that I'm like this big lesbian. I'm not into you, I'm really sorry. And she's like, no, Kat. Naked people are confident people. And she's like, we're in the tropics, we're 20. We are gonna go skinny dipping every fucking night until you feel like your body is the best body ever. Woo, yeah, thank you. Abby's fucking brilliant. Like, she's all zen and yoga, right? And naked people are happy people. And so we start skinny dipping together. And we do it sort of semi on the sly because, because it's a field station and there's all this sexual energy, but everybody knows everything that's going on. So, like, we're night swimming. We're not skinny dipping. We're night swimming. And it started out like just me and Abby, and then like Kara and Sarah join in, and Kara's a little bit like Abby in that Kara's like really confident and her early 20s were good for her. She's like, yeah, I finally have this great body. And then Sarah's like the only person at the field station who's as awkward as I am, and I'm like, thank God, Sarah, just like come be awkward and naked with me. Like, so we're like skinny dipping, and eventually one of the boys comes to join us, and yeah, like it's about fucking time. And so this boy, well, because like this was the plan, like we'd start off at girls, like very like cool, comfortable, and then like boys would come to join us, and then I'd get used to being naked around boys that I wasn't attracted to, and then that would be really easy when I was attracted to them. Anyway, so the first boy that joined us was a young man by the name of Pierre-Yves Cousteau. So, which, he's the youngest son of this man right here. It turns out that the first man I ever saw naked was a Cousteau. yeah. You know you're a marine biologist when. This was a very fitting prize. Thank you. Thank you, Chelsea. I actually looked at the publication date on that book. It was 1975. Jacques had Pierre when Jacques was like 70-something, so in the early 80s. So like that book is older than Pierre. Anyway, so first man I ever saw naked, this gangly French man. And like the thing I remember most is like how he had this epic huge nose. I was totally not looking at the right parts. He had this gorgeous, like beautiful nose. Like, like I really encourage looking him up. He's this really handsome, skinny French man that all other naked men will for always be measured against. Even though all I remember is his nose. So anyway, we're like this skinny dipping little family, and we like skinny dip every night, and it's awesome. And I'm out there taking field courses, and the TAs are totally like turning a blind eye, like no big deal, because like they're like, man, you're 20, like go get naked, you're in the tropics. Okay, so then we move to phase two of the plan, because after like 2 months of skinny dipping with like Pierre and Abby, I am feeling fucking confident. Like, I love my body. All of a sudden, like, I have no problem running around in my bathing suit all the time, blah, blah, blah. Phase two is then social engagement with Mike. Yeah. So Abby and I scheme. We came up with this great scheme where we were gonna have this big dance party. And we were gonna invite a bunch of like the locals to come dance with us, and it was gonna be this big thing. Everyone had to be there. Mike had to be there. If he wasn't there, it would have been a little weird. Because sometimes Mike was a little aloof because he wasn't really into the whole tropics thing anymore, because he's out there all year round and whatever. He's jaded. People get jaded when they're in the field too long. There was some knowing laughs. Okay, so we throw this big party. We invite all these Polynesian, mostly men. I think there was like two Polynesian women that showed up. And we're like teaching them how to salsa dance, because supposedly I know how to do that. And at least 20-year-old me thought I knew how to do that. And we're like dancing and partying, and they brought like a huge trash can full of rum-based liquor, like punch. And it's kind of a wild night. And it's sort of like everything sort of chills out. And like, I don't know, I'm like dancing, and I realize like I'm the only person on the floor. And I'm like, oh, where'd everyone go? So I like go outside, and everyone's like sitting in the grass. And there's like one light that's like hitting from the side of the dorm onto this huge Polynesian guy. Like, huge. So I was this huge-ass rugby player, right? I work for a man who's 6'8", and I was raised by a man who's 6'4", and was probably about 300 pounds most of my life. So, like, when I say a huge guy, I mean, like, massive. Like, I'm accustomed to big men. This guy was massive, and he's, like, playing this, like, ukulele, and he's, like, got this sweet, angelic voice, and he's just, like, la, 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 he's playing. And so I go and I sit by Josh, the postdoc, and Josh and I get along good, and I'm like, hey, Josh. He's like, hey, Kat. I'm like, what's going on? Where's Mike? And he's like, Kat, fuck Mike. And I was like, that's the plan, Josh. Like, and I'm like, no, and he's like, shut up, Kat. And I'm like, okay. I was like, what's going on? And he's like, you see that guy there? Oh, yeah, well, why is he playing the ukulele? Like, Josh, what's going on? And he's like, well, that man there is like the crown prince of Moray Cat, and as a thank you for the party, he is performing for you. And I'm like, oh, I'm such a tactless 20-year-old. And I'm like, okay, I'm shutting up. So like we sit and we listen to this huge man play on his tiny ukulele and sing la 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 la. And and it's like this great, like, chill end of the night. And then everyone, literally, he stops playing. Everyone just kind of gets up and leaves. I'm like, oh, it's okay. Where's Mike? Blah, blah, blah. I guess I'll go clean up from the party. So I go clean up from the party, and Abby comes in, and she's like, Kat, night swimming now. And I'm like, okay. And she's like, no. And I'm like, I'm cleaning, Abby. And, like, I never clean, so if I'm cleaning, just let me do it. And so she's like, no, like, right now, Mike's on the dock. And I'm like, okay, totally ready for this, totally wasted, I'm totally in French Polynesia. I totally have been naked every night for the last 2.5 months with people. I can handle Mike. And so I go out to the dock, and Mike is, there's a picnic bench on the dock, and Mike is sitting on the far side of the picnic bench, and he's drinking tequila, I think, out of a big bottle. And Abby and Pierre are like taking off their clothes because they're going swimming. And so I take off my clothes. And then I go and I sit opposite Mike and I'm like, hey, can I have a drink? And he like passes me his bottle and he's like, you better kill it. And so I kill it. And I like chug the rest of it. And yeah, and then I look at Mike and he's smiling at me and I'm like, this is good. And so I'm holding the bottle. And so I take the bottle and like a moment of extreme bravery, I lay the bottle down and I spin it. Thank you. And I spin it and the bottle is spinning. And I'm like, what's gonna happen next? And the bottle's still spinning and Mike basically jumps across the table and grabs me by the shoulders and kisses me. And woo! It's like totally like trashy romance novel, like passionate, strong-handed kiss, and I'm like naked and he's still fully clothed because he had no intention of going night swimming with us. Like, and so, and then like he like basically puts me back down and I'm just like, I don't know. I probably didn't say anything. I probably stared at him weirdly, like. And then he's like, okay, Kat, I'm gonna go find more alcohol. And I'm like, okay, I'm gonna go swimming. So I can go swimming. And we're like in the like water and we're like talking and they're like, you just kissed Mike. And I was like, yeah, I know, I just kissed Mike. And I'm literally 14. I'm like really excited about it. And then all of a sudden we hear somebody running and I'm like, oh my God, it's Mike. More alcohol, more partying. This is gonna be an awesome night. And it's not Mike, it's actually, 7 French Polynesian men who were at the party earlier. And the one leading the charge is that huge man with the ukulele, the crown prince of Moray. I wish I remembered his name. I think it's something like Tomo or something. And they're all like freaking out at us. And we're like, guys, go away, we're naked. And they're like speaking in French and like a native Polynesian language. And like, they're like, and finally we're like, okay, they want us to get out of the water. And we're like, okay, we'll get out of the water after you guys leave. And they're like, no, you have to get out of the water now. You have to get out of the water now. And we're like, why can't we be in the water? Can't you guys just leave? Like, we're happy. We're skinny dipping. Like, just go away. Like, thank you. Bye. Thanks for coming. It's a fun night. Sleep well. And they're like, no, out of the water, out of the water. And like, my arms waving around being like, night. And the prince leans over the dock and grabs me by the wrist and just like plops me out of the water. I'm like dangling there. And then he like plops me down on the dock and he's like, stay. And I'm just like, I'm naked and all of a sudden I'm not very confident. I'm just like, what the fuck am I doing? And so I'm on the dock and I'm naked and I'm surrounded by these Polynesian men and all of my friends, my skinny dipping support group have scattered. Like, I don't know where Pierre is. And he at least speaks French. I don't know where Abby's gone. Everyone's gone. Because like they were like, we don't want to be exposed and like dangled in front of like the blinding lights. And so I'm just like sitting there. I'm like really, really scared. And like finally, like, these warm, like, hands, like, these long arms come behind me and this deep voice and this towel goes over my shoulder. And Mike goes, "Kat, get inside now." Wraps the towel around me and I just, like, run inside. Yeah, that's what being rescued by French Polynesian royalty is actually like. It's like I was having a good night and I was naked and I was skinny dipping in the tropics and I was making out with this hot guy and now I'm like very exposed and like on the dock afraid for my life. Yeah, so I guess the story's gonna fizzle too. So the next morning, like our nice TAs who had just kind of been turning this blind eye the whole time about a skinny dipping, they sat us all down. And we had two lady TAs and one man TA, and the lady TAs, like Jackie, was just like, she's Mexican, and she just had nothing to say. It was just like shaking her head, like, and that's like worse than like actually being reprimanded. And Katie, who was kind of the earth mother, was like, you know, appropriate clothing, guys, a bikini, it's like less than a foot of fabric. Like, really, what's the difference between that and being naked? And it would like get in the way of so many other things. And my favorite is, I was like, Adrian, who's the dude TA, he and I were kind of tight because, like, one of the advantages of being a rugby girl is it's like, hey, bud. I was like, so, hey, bud. And he was like, don't do that, Kat. I was like, okay, hi, Adrian. What was in the water that we needed to be afraid of? He just, like, stands there and he's like, he can't look at me. He just couldn't make eye contact with me. He's like, you know what, Kat? I don't know, but, when the locals say don't swim at night, like, don't fucking swim at night. I was like, okay. And so that was, like, the end of my skinny dipping in French Polynesia, and basically the end of my skinny dipping actually on field station property at any time. It's not that I'm above skinny dipping, it's just, like, now I like to leave field station property, and, yeah. But, like, what I really learned from this is that, like, I've been doing science for over a third of my life, and I really went from being like a child to like the person I am right now. And sometimes it's the science that makes you into who you are, but sometimes it's the things you do at the field station when you're not doing science that really makes you who you are. and thank you for listening to my story.
Issue of Discorder marked our 33rd anniversary and is on the shelf of cafes, retailers, and record stores now. This month, we feature the sounds of Michael Redd, DOA frontman and politician Joe Keithley, the rebirth of Milk, an overview of Vancouver's underground venue situation, and more. We have album reviews for Nap Eyes and Cindy Lee, and live show reviews of Magical Clouds and Fields. It's all in the pages of your favorite local mag by CITR 101.9 FM. A special thank you to this month's advertisers, The Lido, Horse Records, Recruiting Canada, Vancouver Theatre Sports, The Rio Theatre, The Rickshaw, Vinyl Records, The Live Van, and AMS Events.
Our Are You Aware Radio, alternate Thursday 6 to 7 p.m. at CITR 101.9 FM. Profiling music and musicians take the route of positive action over apathy.
Welcome back. You're listening to Lady Radio on CITR 101.9 FM. You just heard Rotolock by Daphne Orem. That was from her album Oremix, produced in 1958. Thanks to Jules for sending us that recommendation. So Lady Science is an online magazine and newsletter that takes a look at how women are represented in science, technology, and medicine from a cultural and historical perspective. Here's a chat I had earlier today with founders and editors Leela McNeil and Anna Reeser about what they do.
Hi.
Hi, is this Anna?
Yes.
Hi, it's Katie.
Hi.
Hi.
Hello?
Hello?
Yes.
Hi, it's Katie and Anna.
Hi.
Hi.
Oh, hello.
How's it going?
Good.
Good.
So how are you?
I'm good, thanks. Cool. Well, thanks both of you for chatting with me.
Oh, thanks for asking.
Definitely.
So, first of all, just before you guys... I could explain for the listeners later what Lady Science is, but it would probably be more interesting and better coming from you guys. So what is Lady Science?
Okay, this is Anna. So Lady Science is sort of at its heart, it's two essays that are delivered by email subscription. You can also get them on the website now, but we send them out to our subscribers by email, and they're usually... written by myself and Layla, and also sometimes by contributors who pitch us an idea, something that they're interested in. It might be their own research or something they want to learn more about. And both essays are sort of focused on a theme. They're sort of these like quasi magazine / academic articles. We try to be pretty rigorous, but as accessible as possible. We both have a lot of experience with how sort of alienating academic writing can be, so we do a lot of developmental editing to preserve the sort of scholarly rigor, but make it really accessible and sort of geared toward a really diverse audience. Because we have our subscribers, there are plenty of academics, but I think even more sort of just general people who are interested in this kind of stuff. So the core of it is these essays that go out every month, and we've written on a really broad range of things. We've done some sort of historiography, and historiography for the public is kind of a tricky thing to do. Same with more theoretical stuff that we do about gender and technology, but we also write sort of cultural criticism about television. That's one of our favorite subjects. And then we do sort of more, crunchy history stuff that's sort of focused on a specific time and place in history. And then each year, we just finished the anthology for this year. Each year we'll collect all of the essays into a book. They get a little bit of editing, and then we add an introduction and a conclusion and stuff, and put them all sort of in one place as a collection of readings. So that's the other main component of Lady Science.
Mm-hmm. So how do you two know each other?
This is Layla. We were in the History of Science program at the University of Oklahoma.
And so what are your respective backgrounds?
Okay, so this is Anna. I went to grad school for History of Science coming out of a art studio program. So my work for my master's was sort of art history and the history of technology. I work on the American Space Program. And so obviously, there's opportunities there to do things about women, but in the 60s, there are sort of not very many visible women in the space program. And I guess learning more about the space program and writing my master's thesis and also the coursework that we were doing, there's just sort of very little discussion of women in science and technology, more so in history of medicine stuff that we did at school, but it was still sort of very thin on the ground. So I wanted, first of all, to understand why this was, in a historical sense, you know, why there were not very many women visible. Like, you know, there were no women astronauts until the late 70s, early 80s. And there are, like, structural reasons for that. And so wanting to understand that sort of led me to larger questions about science and how women have been sort of historically excluded from science. I'm going to complete my PhD in a few years, and I still work on the space program. And so doing lady science is a way for me to sort of continue this work and work on other periods that I don't do. You know, I don't really do the 19th century. I'm certainly not a medieval historian. But this gives me, like, a really good breadth of history to work on outside of just, you know, I work on one decade in the 20th century and one, you know, the space program. So it's sort of really focused. And this gives me, like, a lot more opportunity to learn about the history of science and women specifically.
Cool. And Layla, what's your background?
I actually started with a background in literature, and I completed one master's at the University of Texas at Dallas in literary studies. But kind of what I was drawn to was writings on nature written by women. And I noticed that there was quite a bit of complicated and complex thought going on about science at the time, in those poems and critical essays and short stories and plays that were all written by women. And I kind of started looking at women in the history of science on the fringes of institutionalized science. And so it kind of led me into the history of science with questions of, well, here's all of these women writing about nature and writing about science, but they're not scientists. They're not considered scientists. So kind of the question, well, why is that? These were, you know, intelligent, sometimes self-educated women creating this discourse outside of institutionalized science about science. And a lot of it sometimes was dissenting voice from institutionalized science. And so I naturally went into the history of science from literature to answer that big question of what was going on here that created this community of women writing about science but excluded them from science at the same time. So that was kind of how I got into this in the first place.
Totally. Oh, man. So for me, it was really funny going through, I think it was in your introduction to the anthology, you wrote, I had this experience when I was reading it of, I first started school when I was 25, and I'd been out of school for a long time, and I was writing one of my first big papers, and it was about women and coding and how, like, you know, they were creating digital space and kind of the contribution there. And I had, like, all these great ideas, and I just didn't have the, like, I just couldn't get it out. And then I read this piece in your introduction, and it was like, that was exactly what I wanted to say, but I had so much trouble articulating it. But it was, the central tenets of science are themselves exclusionary. Objectivity, rationality, and the scientific method are all historically coded male, while emotion, sentiment, and nature itself are coded female.
Do you think that there are remnants of that male-female binary that exist in scientific thinking and in science in general today?
This is Anna. I think it does. I think it's kind of, it's much more underground than it would have been, say, in the 19th century when you have male scientists talking about, you know, lifting up the skirts of nature and investigating what's hidden underneath and that kind of rhetoric. I think we don't see that kind of thing so blatant now, but I do think that the sort of underlying association of women with nature and men with like rational inquiry, I think that that's something that is still really prevalent, and it has to do with these sort of historically constructed gender roles. And we find those in every period that we've investigated. So I think it's still really prevalent, and something that you sort of internalize, or something that you is really hammered into you when you're studying the history of science, are these that science can never be sort of value neutral, that the words that science uses are coded socially, culturally, and politically. So, you know, having a history of science background teaches you to be really skeptical of the things that scientists say about themselves and about their work, and to try and unpick where their language comes from and the sort of underlying ideas that that rhetoric reflects, and gendered ideas about rationality and about nature are sort of they're part of the founding structure of professional science. It's not just like a fringe thing. Professional science is built on these kinds of metaphors. So yeah, like I said, I don't think it's as obvious as it is for other historical periods, but I think that it's still definitely there.
Mm-hmm. This is Layla. Thinking about what Anna was saying, one of the things that I've been interested in is that kind of rhetorical way that science has been structured. And when we look at the kind of changes that scientific writing underwent in journals from the 17th century into the 20th century, what we see is a gradual move away from writing that could be coded female. And that there is a gradual move towards using passive voice. And that used to not be the norm. It used to be a subject-centered type of writing. But in the around the mid-1800s, any type of rhetoric that could be mistaken for sentimentality or femininity was basically systematically removed from scientific writing in scientific journals. And so women who could have a space, a rhetorical space in scientific discourse, really was further moved away from that space rhetorically. And into the early 1900s, we see that kind of being legitimized, that split between female-centric rhetoric and male-centric rhetoric. And that when women did have to move themselves away from writing in ways that could be seen as sentimental and adopting a what was under the appearance of being a gender-neutral rhetoric, they were actually adopting a male-dominated rhetoric and discourse that had actually intentionally moved itself away from being mistaken for being sentimental or feminine. And so that's still in what was happening in the early 1900s in scientific writing until now. A lot of those trends are still there.
Right, under like, yes. The guise of objectivity.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. This is Anna. I think that's the sort of kernel of this, is that the very idea of objectivity is a coded concept, and it's a gendered concept, and so objectivity is supposedly what modern science is built on, and it's built in opposition to subjectivity, which is historically coded as a feminine trait. Subjectivity and sentimentality are feminine, and objectivity and rationality are masculine. So when science touts itself as an objective way to look at the world, it's sort of paradoxically, it can't be objective because objectivity itself is something that is gendered and incorporates an inherent bias.
Right, right. So I guess when you say that it's gendered, the gendered nature of it is something that was, these different characteristics were assigned through culture, right? Is that what you're kind of...
Right. So this is Anna again. This is the sort of dominant model of history of science now is social construction. And that basically just means that any sort of aspect of our culture or any human activity that we engage in, that they are not sort of like just pieces of the background reality of the world, that all of these modes of inquiry are socially constructed, that they're inflected by their by geographic location, by whatever culture they're taking place in. So, you know, when we talk about something like British science is distinct from other kinds of science. And there is no sort of science with a capital S that exists above the plane of the social. Because it is a human endeavor, it's necessarily a social endeavor. So that's why, you know, one sort of quick, straight to the point way to talk about social construction is to talk about theories of scientific racism, where scientists are, you know, under the guise of being objective, are developing theories about racial difference that are, they're not objective theories about how the races can be ranked or something like that. They're ideas that reflect cultural biases and cultural norms that exist in the West. So when you look at other parts of the world, you're not just looking with a sort of pure scientific eye, you're looking with a colonial eye, or you're looking, in that case, it would be with a colonial eye, you know, also. So there's like all these different lenses that science looks through. And race is one of those, gender is one of those, and it has to do with sort of projecting cultural ideas onto nature and making claims about nature that are not objective because they reflect, you know, your own sort of culture that you're, as a scientist, are steeped in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is Layla again. And this is why in Lady Science and in my work individually as well, is that it's so important to be sure that as a historian, that I'm reading the work that was written by the people who the scientists were studying through a seemingly objective lens. So what were women saying about what male scientists were saying about their nature? What were people of color saying about the seemingly objective science coming from, you know, colonial white men? To show that those perspectives, those writings with science, presumed scientific rhetoric and legitimacy, that those were being pushed back against, that women and people of color weren't just passive victims of a white male-dominated discourse, that they were pushing back against these ideas and trying to rewrite a discourse about their nature from their own perspective. So I think that's really a big, important part of Lady Science, is to show that women weren't just taking this, that they weren't just victims of this male progressive science, that they were also, they had ideas about their own nature, and that they had ideas about the nature of men, and that they were going to write about that as well.
Yeah, totally. So you write about having an agenda. For instance, we have stakes in gender equity that we want to make visible through our study of history, and we know that others do as well. We see the recovery of women's stories in science as an essential part of the feminist project, which is kind of what you were just describing. And what what is the construction of a new kind of structure, a new system, like new systems of inquiry? Like, what do those look like?
This is Layla again. So one of the ways that we found difficult writing about women and gender in academia was that we were basically finding ourselves having to write a model of history that was basically built for writing about white men. And that's where you get kind of the interest in biography and things like that. And that's just not what we were interested in, because when we look at a scientific establishment, you're not going to find women there because they weren't allowed there. And so if we're going to stick with writing about history in that way, we're not going to find women. And also, we're not going to find women who are going to meet the kind of status as a Darwin or a Newton or an Einstein. So what we think needs to happen is that we need to look at the ways that women did science in non-conventional ways, which is why we look to domestic engineering and the construction of the housewife, why we look at the women who were deemed as secretaries, why we look at women who were called lady doctors, and see how they were doing science in a way that did not fit into a traditional model. And by looking in those non-traditional spaces, we find that women were very active and people of color were very active, and that they were actually constructing a culture that has not been written about before. And we find that they were at the very heart of scientific thought, not on the fringes like a traditional historical narrative of progress shows them to be.
Mm-hmm. And what is the importance, either in your work personally or in lady science, of intersectionality?
This is Layla. It's for both. I think you can speak for Anna on this as well. If I can't, I'm sorry. but intersectionality is something that's really integral to our personal feminism and also the feminist ones that we bring to lady science as well. When we talk about how women have oftentimes been victims of medical science and progressive science, that those effects were felt 10 times harder by women of color and women of lower classes, and that these intersecting levels of oppression are felt differently across different populations of women, and that we want to speak to those experiences as well. And so when we approach our work, we do ask ourselves, how is this for women of color? How is this for poor women? How is this for Latina women? And those types of questions, to make sure that we aren't only speaking to one experience.
Mm-hmm. Great. I think a lot of my other questions were kind of like all wrapped up in there too. So, is there anything else that you guys want to share about lady science or anything?
This is Anna. I guess just sort of like the nitty gritty stuff is that we're always looking for contributors to sort of push us in new directions. Mm-hmm. So people can pitch us ideas. And that would be awesome. Cool. And one of the other things that's important to us about this project, on a sort of technical or professional level, I guess, is that we want to create a space for writing about women on the web that is sort of very open, and very collaborative. So one of the things that we do is that we have kind of a long pitch process. You pitch sort of a long form idea, but that allows us to, when we commit to a pitch, you're in. We'll schedule you, and we don't do any kind of revise and resubmit. One of the things we are, I think, both really dissatisfied with as scholars is the academic publishing process and sort of how soul-crushing it is on a personal level, and how
the sort of structures of academic publishing leave a lot of voices unheard. So we're looking to sort of pick up those voices that are either don't want to write in academic journals or are having trouble getting their point of view across. So we're open to all different sorts of writing from all different kinds of people. So pitch us ideas. We want to write with you.
Awesome. Where can they find you to pitch?
So our website is ladyscience.com, and all the links are on the top, and there's a form embedded in the page, and you just fill out the form and it sends it to us, and we get back to people ASAP. So that's another thing. There's no waiting for months on end to hear about things. We're pretty prompt mm-hmm. about that.
Listeners can download your anthology, your first year anthology, for free.
Yes, it's a free ebook, and that there's a link for that also on the website.
Yes, and you have very wonderful cover art.
Along those lines, the anthology and Lady Science writing are always free and open access. They'll never be behind a paywall. We find that is also integral to our mission, is making sure that writing about women is free and open to everyone, because that is sometimes we find rigorous academic research about women in history and women in the history of science that we really love and we care about, and we try to link to that stuff when we can, but so many times we run up against the paywall, and one of our things is making sure that won't happen with Lady Science. So
that's all the time we have for today. Thanks for joining us. Make sure to visit anecdotalevidence.ca to get in touch with a science story, and at ladyscience.com to pitch a story to Lady Science. Stay tuned after this for a live broadcast from tonight's UBC men's ice hockey game versus the Manitoba Bisons. We're going to close off with Species by Elliot Sumner on CITR 101.9.
Come and see what it's all about.